Hi, this is Gary Goleman, the American comedian, and I just had the time of my life speaking with Dom Stevens on Spieling the Beans. Spieling, how do you like to say it, Dom? Spieling the Beans?
Been told Spieling.
Yeah, Spieling is the Yiddish pronunciation, I think, or the German is to spiel, to play. So I love that. I love that. It's Gary Goleman, the comedian from America. And I had the time of my life with Dom Stevens on Spieling the Beans.
Hello, and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. This week, I talk to a Peabody-born comedian who you'll know from any of his five masterful TV specials, such as HBO Max's Born on Third Base, in which he lends his meticulous comedic craft to current-day America's Tale of Two Cities-esque wealth gap, or The Great Depression, a tour de force look at mental illness which is as inspiring as it is hilarious. You'll also have likely seen some of his work on a late-night talk show. He's appeared on all of them, and perhaps most notably, his state abbreviations routine on Conan. And if you haven't seen it, Google it right now. You're not going to be disappointed. He recently made his off-Broadway debut with a five-week sold-out run at the Lucille Lortel Theatre with his critically acclaimed one-man show, Grandiloquent, directed by the Tony Award winner Moritz von Stuttnagel, and produced by Mike and Carly Productions, who were behind the smash hit play, Oh Mary. As an actor, you can see him appear alongside Joaquin Phoenix in Joker, Pete Holmes in Crashing, and Amy Schumer in Life and Beth. And as an author, you can read him in his debut book entitled Misfit, Growing Up Awkward in the 80s, a memoir based on his life from kindergarten through 12th grade, which was described by the MacArthur Fellowship recipient Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc as exquisite. First and foremost, though, he is one of the most popular touring comedians, selling out theatres across the US and very recently in London at the Soho Theatre, which is where we met. If you're at all interested in the construction of great stand-up and great narratives generally, then this is the episode for you. So let's just jump right in. Please welcome my guest for this episode, the ineffably talented Gary Goleman. Gary, thank you so much for talking to me today.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I enjoyed meeting you in London, and I'm honored that you included me on Spieling the Beans.
Well, it's an absolute honor for me for you to appear on it. Do you remember the first laugh you ever got?
Oh, I remember the first laugh I got in grade school when I was in first grade. The teacher asked what a chick was, and I couldn't believe what a softball or alley-oop that was. And I remember a really smart girl said, "A chick is a baby chicken." And I was like, nobody's gonna go for a laugh here. And I just I timed it perfectly, and I didn't even raise my hand, and I said, "Or a girl." And the teacher laughed, and all the kids laughed, and it was it was intoxicating, of course. And but I had gotten, I'm sure, laughs at home, and I knew certain formulas to getting laughs from adults. It generally included being either precocious and using words that were above your age bracket, or I didn't like puns all that much, but I liked callbacks, referring to things that had been spoken about earlier in the conversation. So that was always good for a laugh. And yeah, it's such a great question, because it's such an intoxicating feeling, and it feels so good that you want to pursue it and replicate it. And I mean, the only thing that surprises me, and they always say, "Oh, everybody's a comedian," but it surprises me that that's not actually true. That
Yeah.
everybody who's gotten a laugh doesn't become a comedian, and it surprises me.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think people don't sort of, because like you say, it's intoxicating when you get that sort of.
Yeah, well, we have a good propaganda machine here in America that keeps you really from pursuing any kind of artistic endeavor. And there are, I mean, there are so few barriers to entry, and it's only getting easier to start doing comedy. So it's not surprising that there are more than ever. But I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't know any comedians personally, and I wonder how common it is now to for people to know a comedian personally. I know that I'm constantly irritated by people who tell me they know certain comedians personally. So it's again, it's got to be more than ever, it just you frequently have to bite your tongue because they tell you the comedian they know personally, and you have to hold back from bashing. Sometimes they're good comedians, but frequently they're like people that I don't really respect, and I have to bite my tongue.
And now name all of them.
That be fun.
Just be a series of bleeps.
Well, nobody's told me that they know Jerry Seinfeld personally, but I do not think I would be able to hold back from ridiculing Jerry Seinfeld if somebody were to tell me that they know Jerry Seinfeld personally.
Do you not know Seinfeld personally? Have you?
I've never met him, but I've heard so many stories of people's interactions with him, both other comedians and just people who met him in the course of their work or their daily life. And he's almost without exception just behaves in either a despicable or arrogant or obnoxious manner, and it's just he's really objectionable from all the stories I've heard about him.
You think when someone gets $1 billion, they'd get them. And yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Jerry Seinfeld because in your 2024 special, which I keep wanting to call it Mummy, was it
Oh yeah, Mommy Look.
Mummy Look, which it's
Yeah.
not called, but that was what you were
Yeah, that's what
ostensibly
I
called.
opened with, yeah.
Born on Third Base, you do a great Pop-Tart. Bit a big great pop tart routine,
Yeah.
which is of course a subject matter covered by the aforementioned.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself analyzing other comedians' material, and when you write about a certain subject matter, do you have sort of their takes in your mind?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that it was early on in comedy. I mean, probably within the first year I was doing it, and I forget where I came across this, but somebody was saying that the journalist Hunter S. Thompson had to learn how to write. He had written or typed out The Great Gatsby, I think,
Oh, wow.
to know what it felt like to write something great. And I thought, I bet you I could do that with jokes. And I think that is a really good exercise because you learn what the sort of the grammar of joke writing and joke phrasing and how a joke sentence works versus a sentence that you would write for an essay or for even a speech. And so that was really helpful. And I remember one of the comedians I would practice writing his jokes out longhand was Brian Regan, because he had very long jokes, and I really liked that style, because I always felt with one-liners that it would take me too long to build a set. And when you're coming up, that's really the hardest thing is developing material. So I was drawn to the longer form types of jokes. So that was part of my practice. And it's a r really good question. I would say for the first 25 years, if somebody had a premise or a joke similar to mine, I would almost always drop mine, because I was so paranoid, really, about somebody accusing me of theft or of not being original. And so I would there were a few ways to do it. You would ask around, does anybody have a joke like this? And And most of the comedians I hung around with were watching a lot of comedy specials and a lot of YouTube, and so that was a pretty good way. And then I would take a sentence from my idea and Google it, and I still do that pretty frequently, and I still ask around, but I don't, because there's so many comedians, it's so hard to keep track of what has been done. And I guess over the past 7 or 8 years, I've decided the best way to avoid overlapping with other comedians is to write about very specific personal things. And there are still some things that, like, I did a joke on the Born on Third Base about Chipotle, and there were a couple of other comedians who had talked about Chipotle because it's almost like McDonald's, and I made sure there wasn't any intersection. But in general, I try to avoid that. Although with the Pop-Tarts things, I intentionally tried to write a joke that was from a point of view of a poor person's perspective on Pop-Tarts versus Jerry Seinfeld's, what I considered a very lame attempt at a joke on Pop-Tarts that he was convinced was absolutely genius and worth great analysis. So that's sort of the approach I take. And I've heard it said there are no hacky premises, and I guess I agree with that to a certain extent, but I really feel when you're in your first 10, 15 years of comedy, you really have to be careful not to overlap with other comedians, because they're always going to side with the person who'd been doing it longer or who was more famous. And it's just a really difficult reputation, I would think, to get out of once that starts, that this guy does a lot of premises that are overlapping with other comedians. So that's kind of the advice I would give to young comedians, which is the only advice I think that's really valuable. Once you've been doing it for a long time, I think you need to be your own advisor. But I was the good thing about being obsessed with getting laughs since you're 6 years old is that you're kind of a sponge for information about comedy, and there's never been a better time to learn how to do comedy, even before you get on stage, because of the YouTube and podcast access that people have. So and also, a few years ago, I made a list of all the things I knew about comedy, and put them out on Twitter, and you can get them, I think, at Vulture. I think collected all of them and put them in one document.
Going back to a thing you said a moment ago about the Hunter S. Thompson writing out sentences to know what a Fitzgerald sentence felt like, or a Hemingway sentence felt like. Your love of language is so evident in all the work that you do. I think I remember, I think it was Norm Macdonald talking about how he realized you could just use the words of Mark Twain or Oscar Wilde in stand-up sets. There's no reason why that has to be kept in the 18th century or wherever it's from. Is that a similar Was that a sort of similar conscious choice for you to sort of take language that you learnt and you read in bygone eras and incorporate it into sort of modern contemporary stand-up?
That's a great question, and I would love to hear more about what Norm had to say, because we had an exchange on Twitter one day where he said something like that he would memorize the words of famous novelists and writers and say them out loud again and again and sort of make them his own lexicon. But I think that I had a friend who's sadly passed away when I was living in Boston and Los Angeles, and his name was Rick Harris, and he was a wonderful comedian, and he had gone to Emerson College, and we used to have coffee almost every day in Los Angeles, because neither of us could get any work, so we would have coffee across from the Golden Apple comic book store, And then we would go over to the Golden Apple, and every once in a while we would run into Patton Oswalt or Samuel L. Jackson or comic book nerds who are also really famous. But anyhow, one day he said, and I never forgot this. He said, "What people love is to hear words and expressions that they forgot they knew."
Yeah.
And so I started to the thing is with comedy is you think you need to do research and find out take polls at a show and say, has anybody you ever and the next level of comedy I feel is to realize that your specific is so frequently universal, and so it works with words that you love and you haven't heard or used in a long time, but also just experiences that you think that nobody else. I mean, you see it on Instagram and Twitter all the time, where somebody says something, you're like, "Oh my gosh!" And and this came from Ralph Waldo Emerson's Self-Reliance, which I would recommend every artist read, where it's just like you hear somebody say something and you were afraid to share it, and it makes you a little bit angry to find out that somebody, "Oh, that could have been my idea. I could have said that, but I was afraid." So it's a great lesson. So I would say I don't hunt out words in Twain. I mean, I do read a lot of Twain and a lot of Russian and Yiddish short story writers, but I do come across words in listening to books and reading books that I think would be apt for something I'm working on. And I think just a lot of people neglect the practice of reading, because I feel like reading and listening to books is so helpful in increasing your vocabulary and expanding your inventory of words and phrases that you can use in your jokes. But Norm Macdonald, I remember hearing an interview with him with Marc Maron, where he said, "People think I just go up there and talk and whatever I say is funny, but I work so hard at
Yeah.
these jokes." And he's so great at a formula that I think is really the spine of interesting and modern comedy, which is the formula of the simple truth, where with phrasing and also this idea of understatement that Norm was so good at. So he says, Germany took on the world in World War II. Their opponent was the world, and it's just there's no real turn of phrase there. There's no sweaty, sticky setup punch. It's just matter of fact. It is the simple truth, and it is so effective. It's not a very common approach in modern stand-up, I think, but it is to me, and maybe that's why it's so effective, is that it's not that common, so it stands out. But I really admired his approach and sort of his also the fact that he really didn't seem to care, and maybe he did, but he didn't really seem to care whether the audience was on board the entire way. He was going to tell these stories and seemed unflustered when there would be silence or an audience that was not ideal for these ideas.
Yeah, completely. And there was such a sort of efficiency of language. I remember that I think he was saying about how the perfect joke has the same words in the setup and punchline,
Yes,
which he achieved a couple of times on, I think, Weekend Update or things like that.
yeah. I mean, the only thing with that is that it's I think the reason it works is because it I do adhere to the idea that there has to be a surprise in the punchline, but with the setup being the punchline, the surprise is that you never thought that the punchline was going to be the setup. So it's a surprise, and it's again just a really effective turn. It's sort of like the rule of three is very effective, but also with a savvy audience, you can sometimes short circuit the rule of three and get a laugh by saying the funniest thing on the second rather than the third beat. And so, I mean, this is, of course, is what do they call it? Nerdy or wonky approach to comedy writing. But I always used to be very let down when I remember they would interview comedians and they would talk about this one or that one being a real joke doctor, Jay Leno, and he could really understood joke structure and all this. And they never really said what that meant. They never gave specifics. See, this guy always has a good tag or whatever, but I never saw any evidence of that. And I without being really sort of very dry, I've never only in books from old-timey comedy writers have I ever even seen the idea of formulas being explained and stuff. And you can take almost any joke and break it down into kind of a formula. Sometimes it's just as simple as like I said, the simple truth, but sometimes there's exaggeration or a twist or an understatement, and it's really it's very fascinating to me.
And to me, you used the word apt a few moments ago, and
Yeah.
I was listening back to your specials in preparation. The propensity now, how often you used apt really sort of stuck out. Do you have a favorite word, and is it apt?
No, my favorite word of all time is ineffable, and I've never used it in a show. Most people that haven't come across it yet, but it's interesting because it's a word that describes the inability to put something into words, and I think that's such an interesting, ironic kind of word, and also it has the double F's are kind of this kind of soft, roundy sounding word, and then you get the N and the F in there, and then the able suffix. It's just to me one of the all-time perfect words where I feel like I could write an essay on the perfection of the just the analysis and deconstruction of the word ineffable. And I probably came across it in college and just still can't get over it and think about it once a day, and I'll use it in conversation from time to time, but I've never been able to put it into a joke or a story or anything like that. But I did have a friend who suggested I write a book about my favorite words, and I think that would be the linchpin or the keystone to the entire book is going on and on as much as I can about that one, the word ineffable. What's your favorite word?
See, that's an excellent question, and I should have seen it coming. And I should
Ha.
the I'll try and work out an answer to that during the rest of the
Okay.
call and end.
Okay. Yeah.
It was a great title for a special to go alongside, grandiloquent and things like that. Gary Goldman, Ineffable, seems
Oh,
to be
wow.
inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah.
When
I
you say
really like that.
please use it. That would be
Yeah. That's really good.
what a scoop for the pod. If
No,
and then just
it's.
it's just a special thanks. Doesn't need to be very special thanks in the credits. I'll
No,
accept.
I absolutely would. I mean, my next special I was thinking of calling My Philosophy because it deals a lot with how I've cobbled together a way to live over the years, but an ineffable I have a feeling that will be used over the next two or three specials because it's yeah, it's a nice way to work in a word that I love.
Well, I'm presuming it's connected to your philosophy then, because if the show is examining how to put into words what you feel,
Yeah.
there's an ineffability to that.
Wow. All right, I think this is the germ of something really special here.
Forget the interview, we're just workshopping now. This is the well, I use that as a turning point then of you've worked with some great directors on specials, particularly recently, in Grandiloquent and Mummy, and I keep calling it Mummy Look, Born on Third Base.
Yeah.
Moritz van Stroopnagel, I've seen it written down,
Yes.
I've heard it pronounced.
Yes. Yeah.
What the Tony nominee, of course. How was that relationship? How did you work together? Because I direct stand up myself, and I know it's a sort of unique, idiosyncratic sort of rapport you have to develop.
Yeah.
Yeah, what was your experience working with Moritz on
I'm
that,
so
with other directors?
glad you asked that because nobody asks about that, and it is such an integral
Yeah.
aspect of a one person show that I guess I need to be more. I always talk about how intricate his input was in putting this together. So I would say it was to collaborate is such a lever in any endeavor, but it's so unusual in stand-up comedy because we hang around with our friends and we bounce jokes off each other, but there's not the investment you have in somebody who's directing you. So I was very fortunate that I had a director for my Great Depression special. And this was the first time that this ever happened, where the director did much more than point the camera and show everybody where to stand and set up for the show. And that's not to denigrate the directors I'd worked with in the past. That's how a director for a stand-up special 99.99% of the time works. You can't expect much more than that, but because I think there was a documentary aspect to this, and he had worked with other stand-ups extensively, he knew that he wanted to be a bigger part of this, just for the sake of the project. And so I would be on the road, and I would send him either video or audio. He would listen to everything. And he was very gentle but direct, and he would say, "Keep this. We don't need this. This is repetitive, or this gets us out of the narrative." And the other thing he would do that was so helpful was he would say, "Do you have any jokes about this? Do you have any jokes about being hospitalized? Do you have any jokes? Can you write some jokes about electroconvulsive therapy? Can you write some jokes about some other treatments you had?" And that was such a, I mean, that was invaluable, which also means valuable. That's another one of my favorite words, is invaluable. It really is unnecessary to put the in there, but it also feels, I always feel compelled to point out that it doesn't sound like it sounds what it means. But anyhow, so.
Like inflammable.
Yes. So when I met with Moritz, I told him how I had worked with Michael Bonfiglio, and I asked him if that was amenable to him, and he loved it. And the other thing was that because he was a theater director, I was also going to get a master class in acting for the stage, and doing one person shows for the sort of converting a stand-up show with its nature into something that was more theatrical and had blocking and lighting and sound and things like that in a set. And so there was that aspect of it, the converting it from stand-up to theater. And then the other thing that was so helpful was that he did the exact same thing that Mike and I had done, where I would send him video and audio from being on the road and workshopping things during my sets in and out of town. And he would sort of, and he sculpted with me the one person show. And he, the one thing that was particularly, and he helped in so many ways in filtering and editing and adding things, but he was, I would use the word insistent. He was insistent that the beginning of the show come back at the end of the show. And that was something I'd really only learned from my wife, who is a writer, that the she was pointing out when we would go to the movies or we would watch things, she would say, "Now see how the end comes back at the beginning." She pointed it was quite dramatic when she pointed out we went to see Beetlejuice 2 or Beetlejuice, I think it was. And so in preparation, we watched the first one again. And she pointed out how what the characters wanted at the beginning, they got at the end. They wanted a child, weren't able to happen to have a child, and then they were actually they had a child. It was through sort of an adoption at the end. But the point was is that my director was insistent that we find a way to tie in the beginning with the end. And honestly, it was days, less than a week before the show opened, that we finally figured how we could manage that. We were ready to abandon this thing as kind of a too quixotic, but we figured it out and opened the show with it in place, and it was just it was it really worked, and I was so grateful that he hadn't given up. And was so encouraging and insistent on that. So I the same way I credited or we credited Mike with the show being developed by Gary Goldman and Mike Bonfigli, I would say we'll do the same thing with this for Moritz, because it was it's not nearly as good a show without this collaboration, without this input. And I think that any comedian who wants to do their best work should consider leveraging their talent with somebody who can also bring in this type of input. And I'm sure you see the results in when you're directing with stand-ups. It's just it's so valuable.
Yeah, completely. And there's a phrase which I always think of when it comes to theatre or stand-up or any sort of narrative art form, which is unexpected but inevitable. And when you have an ending that's unexpected but inevitable, where you didn't see where it was going, but now that's been revealed to you, you go, of course it had to end like that.
Yes,
Other,
yes. Yeah,
and
that's a great way to put it.
that was very palpable with the Great Depression and other ones too, where you sort of course that's where it lands. Now it is a complete sort of singular
Yeah.
piece. On that point, how do you know when you've cracked a routine or a show? How do you know when it's sort of that's it?
Oh, yeah. Another great question. I mean, it sometimes it's interesting. You know what it's like when a new joke works for the first time. It's a rush just short of getting the chills or goosebumps. It's really similar to that. I mean, your chemistry tells you that something really special has happened, and it's I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say it's the type of thing that comes with attraction to somebody or to a particularly unusual new taste in food or drink. Or I know when I play basketball and it before it even goes in, I know that that the way it felt coming off my fingertips. Or I remember playing baseball and you would just swing through a baseball, and there was a certain feeling, and that's what it feels like with a joke, and I guess in a very similar fashion, the figuring out what the through line is, and how the show will work, and I mean that's the thing that is the sort of the next step in stand up to me at this point. Is most of us can kill and be funny for an hour, but to be funny on one subject with a theme, a through line, and an arc, that's harder. It's not twice as hard. It's probably 20 to 50% as hard, at least at the level I'm willing to challenge myself at. But I think that's it's very important. Oh, Holt, can you hear that by any chance?
No.
You didn't hear that banging? All right, I'm gonna leave the room. I have an interesting neighbor who's having a moment here. So I'm gonna go into the living room here to continue.
Okay, getting a lovely tour.
But yes. All right. So, where was I?
Well, essentially, to
Oh, to challenge yourself by about, like, I think if you can be in a project where at some point you feel over your head and you think, am I going to finish this? Am I going to fall flat on my face? Have I bitten off too much, more than I can chew? I think that's a great feeling to have at some point in the work. I really think that's an indicator that at the very least you'll have expanded your ambition, and will at least. If you're able to follow it through, I think it's helpful in building confidence, or at least a record of having overcome some self-doubt and overcoming that type of feeling. So it's really helpful, I think, to feel a bit over your head at some point in every project. And even if it's just, I don't think I can get this joke to work. This is too esoteric. This is too big of a swing. I think that's a really good place to be in your work.
Yeah, and that's how you grow, is to sort of to
Yeah.
the space to, and in the first part, essentially, an ineffability is when you know when it's,
Yeah.
you well, touching on that then, the routine that so many first learned of your work through, and certainly one that I, every time I stumble upon it, have to reshare. Is the abbreviations, the contractions.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I understand that you've been working on that for a few years, and not quite working, and then thanks to Helvetica, I think it was,
Yeah. Yep.
it ended up in the right shape. What was I know you've talked about this a billion times, but if you'll forgive the indulgence.
Yeah, no, I haven't talked about it a billion times, and it's interesting because I wanted to share one thing that somebody told me recently. At I spoke in an art gallery one day, and I met somebody who had it was a very interesting mixed media painting, but also collage, and it was three-dimensional, and I asked her how long it took her to do this. And she said, "Well, really, all my life," and I thought that was the best. Her name was Allison, and it was like the best response I had ever heard. And that's what it felt like with the abbreviating the states, because I can remember memorizing the state abbreviations for no other reason than little kids have a lot of free time. I didn't have that many books, but I had a a book called The Arrow Book of States. Arrow, I think, was a publishing company or an offshoot of a bigger publishing company, and it was we had had a book fair. I was able to choose two books. One was called Alvin's Swap Shop, and it was delightful. And then the other one was the Arrow Book of States, and it would give you the state bird and the state capital and a map of the state. And so, because we didn't have that many books in the house, especially not for kids, I memorized every page of the book, and so I knew all the states. And I remember thinking how difficult it was, only because so many of the states in without abbreviating started with the same first two letters, so you couldn't really go off that. And so early on, when I started doing stand up, I tried to write a joke, and it was I was using and I feel like the I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, but the Bob Newhart style was sort of the Rosetta Stone for the comedy I do, and maybe modern comedy, and at least long form stand up. And so, in particular, his joke about Abraham Lincoln being guided by advertising executives. I think it was called Abraham Lincoln versus Madison Avenue or something like that. And so I mean, inadvertently or subconsciously, I set it up as a similar type of idea where there were people considering how to abbreviate the states, and just like they were people designing Abe Lincoln's rollout. And so I had that much, and how they were yelling at each other over the how frustrating it was because so many states started with the same first two letters. But then, and I had tried it for years, literally since the first year I'd been doing comedy in 1993, and would dust it off every once in a while in front of particularly good audiences. They'd like the first few sentences, and I could never find an ending. That's the frustrating thing with writing jokes, is it's really hard to find a solid ending, and it's essential. So ultimately, it wasn't until I went on stage and improvised a lie, claimed that this was a real documentary, and then I started talking about the documentary Helvetica. And so what it required was something I had no control over, which was I needed people to believe that this could be a real documentary, and it required sort of the age of documentaries about small things. And so, in a way, it required the cost of making films to be reduced to the point where they could get funding to make a film about a guy who was good at Donkey Kong, and somebody who was good at slicing up sushi, and a documentary about a font, just a single font. And so I was able to, and because it was so hard to get work, if I was trying out new jokes, I always had to have something that worked come right after it. And so I had to have something that worked in order to go into something that was iffy. And so once I was able to get the joke about Helvetica, and people didn't even believe there was a Helvetica documentary, but when you have the facts on your side, which doesn't really matter anymore, but at the time it felt like it was important that I'd be telling facts before I told this ridiculous shaggy dog story about abbreviating the states. So that was the genesis of that. But I will say, even when I got it on Conan, it was mainly the confidence in the booker, JP at Conan, that gave me the confidence to be able to tell this, because it didn't always work. I mean, if I was doing it late night at the Comedy Cellar, which is actually where JP Buck saw me do it. JP Buck saw me do that, and then he called me and he said, "Do you know anybody who does a joke about the abbreviating this of the 50 states?" And it was really fun, but it was I and it was something I used to do a lot, which is to co-opt somebody else's confidence in me to try and get confident in myself. It's not the ideal way to be confident, but it helps to rely on somebody else's because we're not always that objective about our talents, especially if we're self-conscious and anxious people. So that was really helpful.
And like it goes back to the sort of writing out Hemingway sentences to
Yeah.
get the confidence from the booker. And to round up off that story, so you started comedy in 1993, which was I think the year that Conan started hosting
Yeah.
The Late Show, and then your twin sort of train tracks are going. So you then appear in I think like was it 2016 or something like that, where you go on the show.
Well, I did, yeah, but that was my third or fourth appearance on Conan. I had gone on, I think, for the first time in 2013
Oh,
or
sure.
20 or 2012. And then so on my second or third time, I did the abbreviating the States, yeah.
And then when you mentioned right at the back, or right at the start rather, that it was based on the Bob Newhart style,
Yeah.
then I believe as soon as you do the routine, he comes over and shakes your hand and says
Yeah,
that.
that I reminded him of Bob Newhart, who I think he said was one of his favorite comedians growing up, and that was just like this great compliment. And I mean, because I knew of Bob Newhart's acting and sitcom work before I knew of his comedy albums, but I remember as soon as I heard them, I think subconsciously and also consciously, I thought, well, that's the type of comedy I want to do because I remember a high school classmate describing her love of stand-up being that thing where you can't get over the fact that they keep going on this subject that you thought there was really nothing there, and then they keep deconstructing and squeezing more out in the analysis. And so there's this type of joke that I think I pursue, which is the joke where you're laughing, and also there's sort of a this was the case with the Bob Newhart thing, where you're laughing and you're like, you can't get your mouth is a gape because you can't get over that this person in it, and it's also this thing where you almost think they're not crazy, but they have no inhibitions about telling this. Like Bob Newhart, the interesting thing was that he looks like the average office worker, and then he has this almost crazy insight into advertisement and Abe Lincoln, who in the 1960s, it's hard to imagine, but taking on somebody as revered as Abe Lincoln was so irreverent and a little bit risky. People were much more conservative in terms of their view of religion, and also Abe Lincoln was almost a religious figure to Americans and people all over the world, I imagine. So it was risky, I think, and it required a hip audience and also a very deft performer and writer. So it just, I think it would be considered audacious.
Completely. I did my university dissertation on how late night has become more political over time from the Carson era and the Parr era,
Wow.
all the way up to sort of modern era. And around that time, the 60s, it was, I remember, it was the president's golf swing was about the level you could make jokes on.
Wow.
And so, absolutely, to someone as you say, it's like sort of quasi-religious as Lincoln, this great mythological figure. He's almost fictional in how revered to then
Yeah.
come down without also dividing the whole nation. Takes phenomenal written talent and
Yes.
confidence to do so.
Yeah.
On Late Night, I understand that for your bar mitzvah, your mum took you to see Johnny Carson.
Yes.
What was that experience like?
Oh my gosh, it was one of the greatest moments of my life, and so unforgettable because also there was this thing where I was 13 years old, but around 6 feet tall, so I looked like the height of a 16-year-old, but I didn't have any facial hair, and I was so gawky that anyhow, a woman, Paige, asked if I was old enough to be there, and my mother, God bless her, she said, "How dare you? Do you think I would take an underage person to see the great Johnny Carson? I am a shame on you." And so ultimately the woman backed off and I was able to see it. But the guest that day was Carrie Fisher
Wow.
and Gary Shandling. And I had never heard of Gary Shandling. I think this was his second appearance, and his first appearance I've seen, and it was legendary, I come to find out. But then his second appearance is even more impressive because he at one point he said, I know your parents, Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds. Do you know my parents, Irv and Muriel Shandling?" And it got this incredible laugh, and Carson's monologue was incredible that day, and he had flubbed a line, and when he went to commercial, he said, I blew the shit out of that joke." And to hear a celebrity swear, it just was not very it was not very common, and it just the entire experience was unforgettable, and really, I guess, on point for my life in that I was so into stand-up comedy and watching comedians that I would see this a legendary moment on a legendary program. I feel very blessed to have intersected that way. And later, when I worked with Gary Shandling at the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, I told him that story, and he was very gracious. And I have a picture in my living room of me and Gary at the Comedy Magic Club, and you can tell from the photo how joyful I am.
Oh, amazing. That's
Yeah.
I reminded of something you said before, which is as a comedian, you need a place to kill and you need a place to bomb.
Yeah. That's
What?
from Dave Attell. Dave Attell said that, and so I got that either first or second hand.
How do you? I can understand the importance of that, but how do you know this is the place
Right.
I can land, this is the place I can bomb at?
Yeah, I mean, the way I took it was that I need a place where if I do badly, they won't stop booking me.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, and so I found that early on in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Mass, at a place called the Comedy Studio, which was this incredible phenomenon that was above a Chinese food restaurant on right off the campus of Harvard University. And the owner and manager and host of the show is a man named Rick Jenkins. And he, if I don't know how he decided it, but if he thought you had something, he would be so nurturing. And also, if he just thought you loved comedy, he was so nurturing and generous and encouraging, and also he didn't blow smoke or anything like that. He would just give very encouraging notes and insight and compliments, and it was just this place where I was very careful to go on at the end so that I didn't ruin anybody's night by bumping them or reducing the amount of time they could do. And so however much time there was left at the end of the show, I would do that. And at various times in my life, it was something that it was a lifesaver in more ways than one. And so I'm so grateful to that. So that was the place where I would often kill, but I could also bomb. And the main thing was that I could take chances and take big swings. And then I think for during various times, there have been different places where I would go, and I knew that I needed to do really well. And for a long time that was the comedy cellar in New York City. But at this point, I don't work there anymore. I've decided it's more beneficial for me to do an hour and a half or 2 hours at a place where I only need to sell 60 or 100 tickets, and I can work out stuff at a higher volume. So that's my approach these days.
Sure thing. I'm conscious of our time, so I'm going to do two more questions and one is, I understand you're a big craft fan, big Michaels goer. Do you see a link between how you approach collage and similar, and how you approach writing stand-up?
That is another great question. I mean, the thing I feel about collage is that you can't make a mistake, because even if you like, there have been collages that I've had Woody Allen and Bill Cosby on, and I've just gone back and stuck people that are not monsters on top of them, and so I love that aspect of collage. And also, I have a friend who's an incredible collagist named Brian Gordon, and he said that he doesn't put down a piece in a collage until he's considered it. And I barely consider where things are going to go. And over the years, I've found that either by coincidence, luck, or subconscious, I've put things together that are sort of inspired in their connections. And I one example is that I put a picture of Krusty the Clown with his rabbi father, and somehow found a cartoon completely unrelated, not a Simpsons cartoon, of Santa, in which they almost shared the same exact eyes and the beard were almost identical with Krusty. And I never could have planned it. It was just this cool coincidence. So I love that aspect, and that happens so frequently in a joke where you bring about these things. And that was one of the things I learned early on, was, and I don't know that I have a gift for it or a particular talent for it, but making connections between things that are seemingly unconnected is such an important aspect of comedy, and brings about surprise, and brings about that laugh that comes from being sort of in awe of the cleverness of it. And that's been really important to me, is to try to find these connections. And I find that's a lot of putting together a collage is similar in putting together a joke. They seem to be collages of different formulas and context, and it's just being able to bring about different time periods and anachronisms, and it's often the source of a lot of the comedy I love. And that's one of the pieces of advice I love to give to young comedians. And I think it was first said about authors: write the book you want to read. And I've always felt, let's try and be the comedian that we want to see, and that can inform every single choice you make as a comedian. Do you like to see a comedian who wears a suit? Not especially. So I'm probably not going to wear a suit and tie to a show. There are exceptions, but for the most part, I always like to see a comedian who is dressed stylishly, but not. And also the venue matters. I always found it funny that there were certain comedians who had decided they had become a suit comedian, and so they're wearing a suit in a dive bar or some grungy comedy club, and it just you look ridiculous, and you also look contrived. And so that put me off. And I'm sure if there's any comedians who hear this and they'll say, well, I'm the exception. No, you're not, Greg Proops or whoever whoever it is who thinks they're the exception, and they should wear a suit no matter the context, you're not, you look ridiculous.
Excellent advice. My final question is one I asked everyone who comes on the show, which is simply, why do we need stories?
Oh, well, I think I'll try to back into this. I've heard recently, and it's been corroborated again and again in further readings and other sources of input, that humans try their best to fit the occurrences in their life into a story. Our brain is frequently wired to be able to make stories, and stories have been around as long as we've been conscious. And so we have this, and I don't know if any other animal, certainly I don't know of any other mammal who is telling stories. So we have this unique ability, and also we love stories from the time we're little. We love beginning, middle, and end. We especially love a good ending and a compelling beginning. And so why is the question? And I think part of it is it's entertaining, it passes the time, it gives us these jolts of endorphins and oxytocin and dopamine, but also it helps us to make sense of our world. It also can inspire us. So a story of an underdog overcoming can inspire us. A story of somebody's survival can inspire us. And so I think that's why we should embrace stories. And the other thing is that I knew how to tell a story before I was taught how to write a story. And I don't think that's unusual. I think I find out later, and the same thing with jokes, I found out later that, oh, I was using this formula, and I was using this archetype of a story, this outline of a story. And so I think I heard Noam Chomsky, and I'm sure he's not the only one, who says that our facility with language is inborn. We shouldn't be able to accumulate this many words, but it's where they're innate. They may be in our DNA, and I wonder if storytelling is also in our deoxyribonucleic acid. So I think that's possible. So I really long answer to a great question, and I'm sure I left out some things, but that would be my answer. And I just, man, do I love, I mean, I guess I'm obsessed with reading, hearing, and watching a good story.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
And brilliantly relevant to the show, because Noam Chomsky has been on the show, and I
Oh,
asked
wow.
him whether because of the inbuilt sort of learning language learning device, I asked him if narratives was similarly innate, and he said yes, so he agrees with you. I have.
Oh, that's so interesting to hear. You made my day. I mean, this was awesome. I'm so glad we were able to do this. And yeah, I had an instinct just from talking to you. It's interesting because I don't know if you're able to notice this because you're immersed in it, but going to England and being around people from England, I remember my first trip there. I was with a friend, and I overheard, or I was eavesdropping on some children on a school trip to the London Museum. And one of the boys, and he just looked like your typical 10 or 11-year-old. I wouldn't call him a loudmouth, but he was the life of the party in his school. And I remember him saying about a kid. I want to say his name was Ian or Liam or something in that range, and he said, "Watch out for Liam. He's spiteful." And I just remember thinking, there is not a 9 or 10 year old in America that I intersected with growing up who would have used the word spiteful in context, and it made me laugh, and I think about it all the time, and that is not uncommon, especially in adults, to be around a British person who is loaded with words and also tells a great story, tells a great anecdote, and is just a joy to listen to, because I have a feeling that your language skills are a little bit more advanced than generally what I hear, even amongst the educated in America. It's really you are, and it's not surprising that your comedy and your novelists and your artists in general are working on a higher level than the average in America. I would love to see a study as to what your citizens' average age or grade level reading is at, because I feel like I stand out in comedy in America because most comedians write at about a 7th grade level, which is about a 12 or 13 year old, and I can stand out by writing at a 9th grade level, which is about a 15. I write for a precocious 15 year old, and it's a way to stand out in a small degree here. It's a little bit disappointing.
Well, hey, keep going. You'll get to a college level anyway.
Yes.
Keep plugging away.
Yes. Yeah. Dominic, thank you so much. And also I want to, if you're ever in New York, please reach out so that we can talk off camera for even longer.
I would love that. I would love that. Well,
Yeah.
I'll talk off camera in just a moment, and
Yes.
we'll wrap this up here. But thank you so much for talking to me. I'm excited to see your next special, Ineffable. Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure and honor.